Time to take a look at the wonderful world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, works out of the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. Really happy to have him along. And certainly if you have some questions about the bugs you're seeing around your home or just in general, give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890. Give a call. We'll be glad to get you on the air. Phil, welcome.
Nice to be here, Larry.
An army of gypsy moth caterpillars led to the closing of Rocky Arbor State Park last week, if I'm not mistaken. I think it reopens today, as a matter of fact. What's going on with the life cycle of the gypsy moth as it ravaged oak trees in that park?
Well, unfortunately, even though it was a lovely spring, this is not the kind of spring that's conducive for the diseases that help us control gypsy moth. And so the numbers have been quite high. We've seen this in the Madison area where there's a number of big baroques, 100% defoliated, and worms crawling all over. The concern up at the park up by the Dells was that people could potentially transport caterpillars into new parks and continue to spread the establishment. So they shut the park down for almost 2 weeks. Right now, we're seeing adult moths coming out. And there's still a concern because the female gypsy moth does not fly. And she deposits this kind of tannish egg mass on both trees, but also on campers and furnishings and the like. And that's another way to transport these things. But the thing with the egg mass is they won't hatch till next spring. So there's, you know, a chance of getting them cleaned off and the like. And we have had some reports of both virus and fungus disease being quite extensive in particular spots, but overall, I think when the Department of Ag does the end of year counts and surveys, I'm expecting the numbers to be up considerably, and it all again relates to the populations not getting the benefit of these diseases and viruses.
And what's this? Have we been able to slow the spread of the gypsy moths at all here in our? We got about 41 counties.
I mean, it turns out that, you know, there's only enough money to do this slow the spread program, and the firing line used to be between Stevens Point, Madison, and Janesville. Now it has moved westward, this has helped, you know, considering we've been wrestling with this insect for 20 years. I mean, without this, it would have spread much quicker, but you have to realize that's what we're dealing with is slow the spread. Now, we were very encouraged in 2005 when the entomophaga fungus just absolutely devastated the gypsy moth population, but we need cool, damp conditions in May to see that. And again, we had a lovely spring, so we all like the weather, but this is one of the consequences. And so maybe next year we'll get lucky.
Lots of callers online. Let's go to Mike in Castle Rock. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Phil, I've got 150 milkweed plants out here for the monarch butterflies, but I'd like you to recommend a good guide. And secondly, there's we get dragonflies out here, the large ones, very early in the spring, and I don't know, do they hatch out earlier, do they migrate, or what?
Both.
I've never known that.
It depends on the species. The green darner, which is the biggest dragonfly we get here, migrates up here from Kentucky and Tennessee and the like. And we have other ones that do spend the winter, but I'm guessing if you saw them that early, I would lean towards migratory ones.
How about the guide, the butterfly guide?
What are you interested, just in butterflies in general, caterpillars, what?
Just butterflies in general. I've got the Peterson guidebook, but I think there's an old one, but I think there's better ones around.
Well, yeah. In fact, it kind of depends on where you want to take this. There's a great little field guide on the caterpillars, and it also has pictures of some of the adults that came out, and that was kind of a new addition. You know, some of the guides can be far more technical. I don't know if I have a favorite guide. I mean, there was a Butterflies of Wisconsin done by Ebner that was published by the Milwaukee Public Museum back around 1970, and that's out of print, unfortunately.
We did have a show a few weeks back with the author. Name is suddenly escaping me. The title of the book is The Butterflies of
North America?
Northern Wisconsin and Minnesota.
Okay, yeah, and there's that series, field guide series of Northern Wisconsin insects, which is quite good. The other one, I mean, the book that I use, and again, it may be a little more detailed than you want, but Scott's Butterflies of North America. What's good about that is it has a lot of host plant information and the like, but that may, as I said, you know, when you start going from the 150 species we have here up to the, what I'm guessing, about 600 species in the U.S., you got a lot of stuff you'll never see here. So, as I said, that Northern Field Guide series may be as good as you can get your hands on and relatively inexpensive, I'm guessing, for about $15 or less.
The author, Butterflies of Minnesota and Wisconsin, Tom Weber is the author, and he's actually a science teacher in Duluth. So a really good, knows his stuff, and there's some great photography. He has some great photos in the book. So that'd be worth a look.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it's not very expensive, given the quality of the book and the photos. Ken in Dubuque, Iowa, it's your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Yeah, we recently bought an older home, 1906. It was built in 1906. It's a wooden home. And when we purchased it, it was still winter, and they had a pest inspection done. But we now have these large black ants running around our porch, and I'm concerned that they may be carpenter ants or some other detrimental ant. And I'm wondering, first of all, would a pest inspector have been able to find those in the winter? And secondly, how can I tell one black ant from another?
Well, technically, it is not easy to tell ants apart, but it turns out if you've got a moderate-sized black ant running around in the house, the chance of it being a carpenter ant is about 99%.
Okay.
It's tough. I honestly am not in favor of the state disclosure law for real estate that causes people to sign off on termites, which makes a lot of sense, other wood-destroying insects like powder post beetles. But carpenter ants biologically do not eat wood. And for that reason, you know, we probably misnamed them, whoever came up with the name. The reality is they are often associated, when they do nest indoors, with wood that has been compromised by water. And so the mistake people see is they got the porch footing rotting out. They see ants there. They say those damn ants ruined the porch footing. The ants moved in it after it rotted. And so the water did the damage. And so the first thing I try to get people to just sit and think about that if they do have damage, it's going to be water-related, not ant-related, and not to lose too much sleep on it. It's tough. I mean, if an inspector goes in there and you have a bad trust in the attic, he's not going to probably see that, especially a pest control inspector. And so it is common for people to overlook this. But again, where I hate to see people overreact and you know, spend $3,000 getting something that controlled with a can of Raid in the right spot in two squirts would solve the problem. And so that's what I usually tell people. Take your time. Try to figure out what's up. You know, if all the ants are disappearing in that porch somewhere, there may be a bad board. The roof might be starting to rot. As I said, it doesn't take much to deal with the ants if you know where they are, and then you can address the problem. But don't worry about the ants causing the porch to fall down, because that's not the way they work.
Fantastic. It's very reassuring. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Ken. Thanks for calling. Rick in Thorpe, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Phil. We've got huge silver maples in our yard, one right over our deck. And I know you've talked about this, and I kind of forgot. There's some bug up there is chewing on the leaves, and then it's almost like sugar comes down onto the deck, and it's just been a mess. And it lasted this year a long time.
We have had a heck of a population of an animal that is called a woolly alder aphid. And what people might be seeing on the undersides of their leaves is almost a white cotton candy. And if you go poking at it, the cotton candy moves because there's little insects underneath the waxy filaments. And it's interesting, many times when aphids feed, they secrete large amounts of sugar water. We call it honeydew. And so you get this shiny, sticky material. But in the case of the woolly alder aphids, most of the complaints I'm getting this year is exactly what you're seeing, are these little whitish balls of sugar-like, almost gel that is being secreted. And now... The life cycle of the insect, it spends the spring on maple, it migrates to alder in some cases in the summer, and then comes back to the plant. And it's there every year, but most years the numbers don't get high enough to even cause any kind of concern or even catch people's attention. But it's the opposite this year. I've been getting numerous calls and emails and whatnot for the last 2 or 3 weeks. So the main problem is just the mess on lawn furniture, decks, those kind of things. And we're far enough along that I'm guessing that they will be coming under natural control. If this was May, early May, and it was just starting, I'd say, well, then maybe you want to intervene. But, boy, I'm not so sure it's going to be worth your effort now. I think you've probably seen the worst of it.
With a tree that size, I don't know how you intervene anymore.
Well, I mean, one of the options, here's a case where the Bayer systemic insecticide, the tree and shrub product that is sold, would work, although you know, I'm guessing that it may cost you $30 or $40 worth of chemical to treat a tree that big. And so then you're weighing, is it worth it? The other thing is that you would have to put it on in early, to, well, about mid-April, in order to get it up in the tree in sufficient numbers to do the job. And so if this persists, that may be a consideration. But I will also tell you that my experience with this critter is it's bad once every 5 or 6 years, and it's not an annual problem in most cases.
Seen a little bit of it, yeah, this year's bad. That's that the same product that they're talking about for the ash borer to use?
Yes, it's the same insecticide.
Okay, I was just wondering if we're going to put up with this all summer, but it seems to be ending that.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Thanks a lot for calling. And Jay in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Jay.
Yes, hi. Good morning. I'm trying to identify an insect that I saw about a week ago. It's about the size of a yellow jacket. It emerged out of my garden soil, out of like a brown casing. The insect was about maybe half an inch long. It had black wings with an orange body, a real sharp contrast in the colors. And then on the back side, on the top, it had three black dots in a row. It's, like I say, it's about the size of a yellow jacket, but it looks more like a fly than a yellow jacket. And I was just curious because I'd never seen anything like this before. Any suggestions?
Do you, now, this is probably not a fair question, but do you know if it had one pair or two pairs of wings?
It looked like one pair, and it looked like the legs underneath had like jagged sawtooth shapes underneath the black wings. The black wings were swept back and met the body, and but the wings were dark black and the body was a bright orange.
Hmm. Yeah, a little bit stumped on that one. I mean, with the one pair of wings, it's got to be a true fly. Although what's deceptive here is that some of the wasps have two pairs of wings, but because they're joined together, they function as one. So I still cannot rule out. There is, in the thread-waisted wasp group, which are often ground-nesting solitary wasps, a couple species that are getting quite similar. But then what really threw me was the three dots on the back, because that doesn't fit some of the thread-waisted wasps that I would be familiar with.
Yeah,
but that would be...
It didn't look like it had the small waist of a wasp. The body was like one long length. And as I mentioned, the wings were pitch black, and then the body was a bright orange, like an orange fruit orange color. And then along the back, all in a row, right in the middle, going towards the backside, were one, two, three black dots.
Okay, well, the other possibility is... There is a group of primitive stingless wasps that are called sawflies, and there are some sawflies that would somewhat fit that description, and they do spend the winter as cocoons in many cases in the ground, and that's what you would witness is one emerging from a cocoon. But as I said, that's a bit of a guess on my part. I'm not convinced that's what it is. And unfortunately, so there's enough things that somewhat fit that I'm not so sure I'm going to be able to give you a more definitive answer.
Get a photo.
Yeah.
Get a digital photo and send it in to Phil. That would be the best.
Yeah, I checked on the internet and went through I don't know how many pages of insects and just could not find what I was looking for. And I've lived in Wisconsin my whole life, and I've never seen anything like this before. There were a number of these casings all over in the garden, and I was just stumped, which is why I was calling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, boy, it would even, to be honest, even though the critters might be long gone, if the casings are around at all, you could send me the casing, and to be honest, I might be able to piece it back together, because often there are remnant pieces in the cocoons, and we can reconstruct what it is, and at least it would tell me what order of insects we're dealing with, and then we may be able to get a little bit farther. You know, that's the problem with the sheer number of species. There's a guide. I have an insect ID section on my site, but I, you know, with 28,000 insects, there's no way I have everything that's listed. There's a site that I use quite a bit called Bug Guide, which has just literally thousands of pictures. But, you know, with that site, if I know what I'm looking for, I'm okay. But the general public saying, go to Bug Guide and look for an insect, you could spend 3 days there and not get to see everything. And so... But as I said, I would be more than happy if you can find any kind of remnants still in the soil of those pupal cases or cocoons. That would be a way I think I could get you pretty close pretty fast.
Okay.
All right. Great. Thank you for your help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in with your insect question as well at 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area at 263-1890, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And we did have a couple emails I wanted to pass along. Simon and Mary from Lake Waseca, Grand Rapids, emailed in to say, we live in central Wisconsin, have a strange bug problem. Our deck is being bombed. Small black peppercorn pellets that are green if you squish them. Also small bits of shredded oak leaves. Every morning I found the whole deck is covered with these tiny caper-sized balls. They look like bug poo to me.
And they are. I'm real suspicious they got gypsy moths up in the oak trees, because yeah, that's one of the things that you see.
Coming out of the oak tree, they say. So.
Yeah, and they may not be numerous enough to defoliate the tree. What you may start to see now are, you know, most of the larvae I'm seeing are 2.5 inches long, have 5 pairs of blue and 6 pairs of red dots, and they are somewhat bristly caterpillars, and they will start crawling around on the trunk of the tree and areas around there, and very shortly start to spin cocoons down. So, you know, it's past the point of worrying about treating them for this year, but boy, you need to be geared up next year in early May if you're going to treat the tree, or between now and early April, we can use this soybean oil product called Golden Natural Oil on the egg masses. That's often something people are more comfortable with. And, you know, for every egg mass you spray with the oil, you're taking 150 caterpillars out of next year's population. And so that's an efficient way of doing things. And they said they're giving you a bit of a warning. And that's what we witness in many of these trees in Madison. Aside from the trees defoliated, you got to go out and sweep the sidewalk. There's so much of this pelleted, we call it frass, that's coming from the caterpillar feeding.
And Jeff had, maybe a similar type issue here. He talked to a DNR forester and was getting a caterpillar ID, and he got some of that information, but no mention of the cut-up leaf pieces around the young larvae at this time of the year. So he still wonders how that works. Seems like something wrapped the leaves in the gallery from last year's worm around the egg and then deposited it in the location. And he says he found these leaf pieces in the new larvae this spring while splitting the oak. Might just this be another insect, just the abandoned gallery of the carpenter worm? Carpenter worm is what he had originally.
Okay, carpenter worm is an insect that bores in and you get a little bit of bleeding, but they leave a hole behind. And if you found leaf pieces in there, I think you've got one form or another of leafcutter bee or wasp. Now, leafcutter bees go out and cut these little plugs, put them in a straw-like hole, and then they collect pollen. So they'll put a pollen ball in there, they'll lay their egg, and then they'll partition it off with another piece of leaf, go out, get another pollen ball, and there'll maybe as many as 6 or 8 of these in that tube that they construct.
Okay.
Now, in the case of wasps, some of them, again, use leaf partitions, but in this case, most wasps are predators, and they will put their prey, whether they're spiders or little crickets, it just depends on the species, and do the same thing. And so I think that's what you saw is one of those wasp or bees that have utilized the old carpenter worm gallery. And we have smaller species that do this in the leafcutter bee group. You know, some we're talking about little straws, 2 millimeters in diameter that they would utilize, versus some of the big ones will get up to be 1/2 inch. We see the same phenomena sometimes in ventilation channels in windows. If you think about it, it's a straw-like thing, and if some insects get in there, they plug it up with snowy tree crickets or whatever their prey happens to be, and then sometimes when people are changing the windows, especially putting storms on, they see this. And so that's what you're seeing is the remnants of either the leafcutter bees or some of these parasitic or predator-type wasps.
Bob in Darlington, hello to you.
Hello, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Dr. Pelletieri, I was wondering how common the brown recluse spider is in Wisconsin, and also the black widow.
The brown recluse is not officially recognized as being established in Wisconsin.
Oh.
I have seen in my career of 30 years 3 populations, one in Madison, one in Janesville, and one in Racine. And we know that they are brought in here every year by the dozens, if not hundreds, and they just don't take. And so, again, the normal range is considered central Illinois, and they're considered out of their range when we get them here. The northern black widow spider is endemic to the state. It is found statewide, It is a very secretive and quiet spider. And so unless you know what you're looking for, it's interesting to me, again, with running the lab for 30 years, nobody has, no, I shouldn't say that. I've only seen one case sent to me. And in this case, there were five spiders, and I was so amazed. And it turns out the woman was the daughter of a biology professor up at the University of Oshkosh, and she knew what she was looking for. And so, as I said, if you know if where to go look for them, you can find black widows, but they are not a common spider. And again, I'm sure it's happened, but I've yet to have a report in my lab of somebody who was bitten and had reactions to black widow bites in Wisconsin.
Hmm.
Well, when I was working in the pharmacy school, I called you over to my office, and you picked up a black widow that I got for you.
Yeah, most of the black widows I see come in on produce, grapes.
Yes, this one came in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those are not the northern black widow. Those are often, there's two other species of black widows you can run into, and the southern black widow is often seen on produce, and it comes in, and, with chilled grapes, they never really go anywhere, And it's interesting, if you go into states where black widows are quite more common, I know back years ago I was hiking down in New Mexico with some Boy Scouts, and I was amazed if we'd leave our backpack sitting there that the next morning the number of black widows we found just kind of crawling around, and, really not much of a concern. You just kind of brush them off and go on with things.
Which is the most poisonous of the two?
Well, the thing about recluse is it's almost developed an urban legend about it. And although we hear of people getting diagnosed all the time with the bites, Rick Vetter, who is at the University of California, has done a lot of work. And he's found that half the cases of brown recluse that have been diagnosed are in states where the spider is not found. And so what it has evolved to is that a lot of these were not spider bites. They were bacterial infections with some of these staph infections that the physicians have wrestled with. But the classic recluse is supposed to be an ulceration that keeps getting bigger and bigger and, lots of skin and damage and scarring. In the case of black widows, it's more of a neurotoxin, and it tends to make a lot of severe abdominal pain, and people feel just really terrible for a few days, but is not considered, in most cases, life-threatening. It's just a very unpleasant experience. And as I said, we just don't seem to get those cases very often now, although if you go back into the old literature, there were a lot of cases of black widow bites when we used to have outdoor toilets. And, that's a kind of secretive environment, old attics and, tool sheds where the spiders would be. And when people would sit down, unfortunately, they'd sit down on the spider. And that's one of the best ways to get bit is to have one in a confined case like that. And so, as I said, there are lots of old records of black widow bites in the state, but I just don't hear of any new records.
The brown recluse is becoming sort of legendary.
Oh, no question. And as I said,
yeah.
If you really want to get a true picture, if you do a search on Rick Vetter, you'll get to his site, and he's got all kinds of good information, good scientific-based information on research he's done and other people, which kind of debunks a lot of the urban legend aspect of it. I mean, if we lived in Arkansas and somebody said they got bit by a brown recluse, I would believe them. I mean, the spider is quite common down there. But as I said, it's quite interesting to hear about all these cases in states where the spider is just not found. And that's what, again, has led us to understand that there really are other things going on that are causing these ulcerations and growing sores. And usually there are bacterial infections.
Bob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. And Mary in Door County, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. The reason that I'm calling is because I have found just recently several very large spiders, and they're black, and they're about 4 inches in diameter. The body is about, I'm guessing, 1/2 inch to 3/4 inch, and about 1.5 inches long. The legs are sort of a black and tan striped, and I've never seen them this large up here before, and I'm just wondering if you might know what they
sure.
are.
Because of the size, they have to be a wolf spider, and there are various different species of wolf spiders. And wolf spiders are really quite common, and the way I describe them to people is they're kind of like baby tarantulas. I mean, that's what people would describe them as. They're somewhat fuzzy. They're somewhat colorful. The banding legs was the dead giveaway when you describe that. They are a nighttime hunting spider. And so they wander around at night looking for prey. They do not make a web, per se, like some of the orb web weavers. And for that reason, they occasionally wander into garages, into houses, and tend to scare people. They're harmless. They will not stay in the house. That's not a good habitat for them. They have to be out in the woods again, wandering, looking for food. And Yeah, some years we have more numbers than not. You would tend not to find them in a city very commonly just because you don't have the right habitat. But out in rural areas, again, they really are a lot more common than I think people think.
Is there a reason that they are that large this year?
No, there are species that are always that large. Okay. I mean, there are small wolf spiders that are not much bigger than the size of a dime. But as I said, there is a number of at least three or four species that run that, you know, boy, we're talking, as you say, 3 inches, 3.5 inches when the legs are extended, maybe even a little bigger than that.
Yeah. There's also a spider that I found legs to, and I'm not sure if this is one that was in the house recently or if when I was cleaning I found them, but they sort of have the same herringbone type of a leg, that feathery leg like a bird feather. Do you know what that might be?
No, spiders, to be honest, with the number that we have, are really quite difficult to identify. And what helped with the wolf spider is just being as big as it was. But, you know, when we normally have to identify spiders, we have to look at their face, see the orientation of their eyes, and look at their legs and other things. And so, unfortunately, just seeing the legs, there's just not enough to go with there to identify it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. Wes in Milwaukee, on to you now.
Hi. Good morning, Phil. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
Phil, this is Wes from Burner and the Extension Service. How are you doing?
Doing okay.
I got a question on deer ticks. Now, I've heard a lot from you over the last few months on them, of course, and there's always one thing that never seems to be asked, and that is... Seeing as I had Lyme disease about 3 years ago, it's kind of put a crimp in my enjoyment of the property I have up in Waupaca County. And I'm wondering if there's any research going on that is specific or an agent specific to controlling a biological control of deer ticks. And if you might possibly know, is can I get it more than once? Lyme's disease,
yes,
that is.
I think potentially you can, but it's hard to say what your response will be because your antibodies have developed some level of protection. So that one is, yes, you could, but it's hard to predict how you're going to react to it, I guess. And now, as far as, you know, there are understandings of little parasitic wasps that help reduce tick numbers, but there doesn't seem to be the chance that this would, quote, control it. And so the one thing I will tell you that was developed in the last few years that had some promise, you know, people who frontline their dog are putting on a chemical on the dog called fipronil. And if the tick comes on to the dog, it will die. And so Bayer, the people that make the aspirin, had released a product where what they were doing is drawing mice into bait stations that, when the mouse came in to feed, they were putting the fipronil-like product on the mouse and then letting the mouse go. And then any ticks that got on the mice would be affected. And it took some time. Over a two-year period of time, they would reduce the tick numbers something like 85 to 90% and reduce the amount of Lyme disease in the area by a similar factor.
Wow.
So this came out on the market about 2 years ago, but it was not an inexpensive treatment. Costing in many cases, you know, a couple hundred dollars minimum for a small property and for a big property more. And as far as I'm aware, they have taken it off the market just because I don't think they sold enough of it to warrant keeping it on. It's a very novel idea, and if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. But as they said, I don't know why it had to cost so much. I'm sure it was part of their developmental costs. Because a bait box and a little bit of mouse bait and a little bit of chemical shouldn't by nature be that expensive. But so as I said, that was a very interesting way of reducing tick numbers, very successful in reducing Lyme disease over a period of time. But as I'm aware of right now, it's not being commercially available this year.
Yeah. Well, last month you did mention the product that you can buy at the sports stores for putting on your clothing that would also kill the ticks. But, you know, I'm in 40 acres, and I do have enough deer mice that are getting in the bathroom, and it's pretty stark conditions, just an outhouse, and I do have an Airstream that they get in, but they don't get in the cabin. I've even had, right at this moment, I've been kicking out deer mice in my house in St. Francis. And I'm assuming that those aren't carrying ticks yet, but that's probably coming.
Well, you know, it has been interesting to watch the deer ticks move through the state. We are starting to get more activity on the eastern side. You know, there's some populations down in the Kettle Moraine. There's some populations up in Sheboygan that have kind of all of a sudden appeared in the last 4 or 5 years. But still, it's relatively infrequent, and it doesn't seem that it's ever going to be near as numerous as it is in places like Washira. And you know, when I think about getting into good deer ticks, you know, up in La Crosse area, that whole northwestern part of the state has always had higher numbers. And I will tell you, and you probably heard me say this on the show before, but this has been a heck of a year for ticks. And right now what I'm seeing coming in are the immature stages, the nymphal stages of the deer ticks, which are more easily overlooked. And even though the wood tick numbers are starting to go down, you cannot let your guard down anytime there's no snow on the ground. And so, you know, I people, I think, as I said, if I had to make a prediction, and we have watched the cases of Lyme disease continue to increase year in, year out, and I would anticipate we'll see a record number again by the time the figures come in this year, because, boy, there's enough ticks out there that we got to believe that this will continue to be a, unfortunately, slowly growing problem for us.
Now, those areas like Milwaukee that are starting to have deer ticks coming in, has there been any signs that these may have or be carrying Lyme's disease?
Well, you know, the figures that we often share with people is, in studies that have been done, on average, about 18% of the adult ticks are carriers, and half that number of nymphs, you know, is 7 to 8%. And that has to do with how many times they feed on the mice. But some studies done out of Stevens Point tell us that, you know, they've got a pocket in Stevens Point that is half the ticks that are carriers, but yet they get down into the Kettle Moraine area, and it's 2 or 3%. And so there does seem to be at times that when the ticks first get established, there's not as much Lyme disease. And we don't quite understand all those dynamics. But as I said, I don't understand why there's this bad pocket in Stevens Point. Whereas on average, if we look at what's happened throughout the state over the years, it's a little less than one in five adults in about 1 in 10 of the immature stages that are carrying the disease.
Interesting.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's helpful. And if anything should revolutionary information come out on tick control, mention it on the air, and you'll make me a happy man.
All right. Will do, Wes. Thanks a lot for calling. Mary in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Morning.
We just got back from a week's vacation. We live on the Fox River, on the river, and the amount of spider webs, some kind of bug debris, et cetera, in my house is pretty gross. And I was wondering, is there anything precautionary I can do? I mean, some people spray and do different things, but does that work? Or what could I do to reduce this?
Well, in general, when I get calls about spider problems, I tell you 90% of the time it's people that live close to a source of water. And the main reason is that there's so many insects that breed in the water, lake flies and may flies and caddis flies. And then because people are close to that, they have security lights on. And as you know, lights draw insects like crazy. And the spiders aren't dumb. I mean, they eat insects for a living. And this is the greatest place in the world to set up your webs. And so that's why you see so much activity on boat docks and in overhangs on the house and that kind of thing. The sprays do two things. They help reduce the insect to some degree, and they, on contact, kill the spiders. But they're really a short-term fix. I mean, you're not changing the environment that much. One of the things that is worth considering is to, at least on the lighting that you have, use lights that are less attractive, the sodium vapors and other types of bulbs that have less UV in it. And so if you've got less UV, you're drawing less insects in. But that in itself will not solve it. And so, unfortunately, you know, if you have to get out there once or twice a year and sweep that stuff or wash it off, or again, if you're going to be treating, often the appropriate time to treat is probably the middle of May. And then it in some cases, it does have to be reapplied along about the middle of August to get kind of a season-long type of knockdown. And the best spider materials honestly are used by professional pest control people. And it's not that they use different chemicals, but they are formulated in different ways. They often use microencapsulated or wettable powder types of products that stick on the surface for a longer period of time, whereas most of the stuff that you buy at the hardware store is a ready-to-use liquid that, although it will work, doesn't work near as long. And so for people that are really serious about this, you know, one of the things to consider is either to get professional help or to spend the time chasing down the specific products. And if you want to go that way, I guess what I often suggest to people, if you get on the internet and you do a search called Do Your Own Pest Control, you'll find three or four sites that sell the same chemicals that the pest control people use. There's no legal reason they can't. It's just more, right, in this case, a marketing decision. And I will tell you that I found those sites to be quite helpful as far as background information. And if you do spider control under the one, they will give you three or four products and how to use them and what things to consider. And the one problem there, though, is you're probably going to have to buy some form of sprayer, because these will be concentrated products that need to be mixed with water. That will be more economical in the long run. But again, if you've got a two-story, you're going to kind of have to climb a ladder to spray the overhangs. And so there are some logistics issues, but that would be the direction to go, is either seek professional help, and they've got the equipment and know the products to use, or again, rather than go to the hardware store and think you're going to buy something, you're going to have to do a little bit more detective work to find the proper things.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. Thanks a lot for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Lots of callers online, so we will go right back to the phones. And Marlene in Twin Lakes is next. Hi, Marlene.
Hi. I love your program and listen to all the time.
Thank you.
I wanted to know, last year you had talked about getting rid of yellow jackets and white moths by some solution, a homemade solution that you put in a gallon jug, and it contained a banana, vinegar, and sugar and water, and that's all I remember of it. But it worked, and it was something that was not offensive to have, you know, spraying on people or whatever. And I was just wondering if you remembered that, or if anybody recalls that recipe. Because it involved
a banana peel.
A banana peel and sugar and vinegar.
Cup of sugar, cup of vinegar, and a gallon of water.
I would use for picnic beetles. I don't think I would use that combination for yellow jackets.
No? Okay. It was for white moths, actually, for your garden. And it started out to be that, and then yellow jackets or whatever, I don't know, came in there, too.
And I guess I don't know quite what you mean by white moths in the garden, because I don't associate any white moths as being pests in the garden.
They're little white things that, and they lay eggs, and they have green caterpillars or...
Oh, you're talking about imported cabbage worm. I would have no faith in that for imported cabbage worm. And I have seen those home remedies. I mean, I'll give you an example of people that talked about putting white flour on the plant and they would eat it and explode. Well, that's an interesting observation, but it doesn't work that way. The same with baking soda, giving to ants, and it's supposed to affect their acid and cause an explosion. That also doesn't work, so...
I don't want exploding bugs.
Yeah.
No.
For the imported cabbage worm, if you want to go organically, there's a bacterial insecticide. The BT products, the dipels or thuricides, that could be applied onto the plants. The little caterpillars will feed on it and die. I mean, it's a bacteria. So there are some other options, but I don't know of any, again, home remedy concoction. And as I said, when I think of the banana peel and the sugar and the vinegar, that gets to be fermenting. And so things that are attracted, picnic beetles would love to go into there and would drown and die. And you may catch a few yellow jackets, although I tend to think things like Mountain Dew Pop mixed with water and soap tend to be a better thing for yellow jackets.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Marlene. And somebody was talking about that recipe the other day on the show. But sometimes it can attract... bugs in too.
There's lots of things that like sugar. There's lots of things that like fermenting thing, and it's much like there's a trap out there called the Big Stinky, and it's made for catching flies. And what you do is you put some very foul smelling thing. You catch tremendous number of flies, and I know people that have used it to control house flies and the like. Well, that's not the flies they're attracting. They're attracting carrion flies and the like. And so, again, you can catch a lot of bugs. But typically, if you've got a specific insect you're after, it probably isn't going to be that easy.
Yeah, understood. Kent and Marinette, your turn. Hi, Kent.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have seen a couple new critters in my yard this year that I haven't seen previously. I'm religiously out there every morning with my spray bottle of liquid soap trying to kill those gypsy moth caterpillars, and I've seen these other two. One of them is a long, thin caterpillar, I guess, for better lack of a better word. It looks like a worm. It's gray, and it has no hair or anything on it, and it moves like an inchworm.
Well, you know, there is a whole family of moths that we officially call inchworms. Earlier in the season, we had a brown-backed and yellow-tummied one called a linden looper that had a great time defoliating various trees in the northern part of the state. There are numerous species that run the grays and browns. In fact, when the things don't move, they look camouflaged like sticks. And so, you know, I'm pretty sure you've got one geometrid or the other, but it doesn't, at least on the top, sound like one I'd be too worried about.
Okay, I've only seen a couple of them, but it was something that I hadn't seen in the previous 18 years that I've been here.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, they're so well camouflaged that I think, again, it's something that's a little more common than people may realize, and there are also some that are only associated with certain plants. I'm guessing off the top of my head that we probably have at least 150 different species of inchworms in the state.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Kent.
The other critter.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Is small, kind of round, hard-shelled bug, but it's not red like the ladybugs I'm used to seeing. It's very light brown, almost white, with black spots on it.
Boy, again, there's enough beetles that fit that category. It doesn't ring one in particular.
Okay.
You know, here again, if you get a chance to catch one, or if you've got a camera that can take a decent picture, right now I'm running over 40% of the things that I see are digital images that people send me, and it's amazing. As long as it's not blurry, I can usually give you a pretty good idea. In fact, to be honest, your description, the more I think of it, there's even a couple stink bugs that would fit that description. But as I said, there's a number of beetles that would fit it too, and so that we'd have to get a little bit closer look at what you got.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yep, thanks, Kent. Appreciate it. Barb in Milwaukee, hello to you. Thanks for calling.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
I think I caught a blue wasp. I opened my screen door in the front, and I normally don't use that door very much, and two of these fell out. And so I captured one, and then I went and looked at the door, and there was like this white, papery filament, several little blotches all along the door. Can you tell me about the blue wasp?
Well, I mean, there are a number of wasps that are blue. There are cricket hunters. There are mud daubers that fit that description. Generally speaking, most of the paper wasps, the true paper wasps, have some yellow markings on their body. And so I'm not sure there. But as I said, there's a family of thread-waisted wasps. Most of them are predators on various insects. Most of them either construct mudden-type chambers or will utilize pre-existing holes or, in some cases, dig holes in the ground. So I need a little more information, I guess, to tell you which one I think it is.
Well, where can I send the specimen?
You can always bring specimens into the local extension office, and if they can't identify it, they'll send it in to me anyway. But my address at the lab is 1630 Linden, L-I-N-D-E-N Drive, Madison. The university zip is 53706, and if you just send it to the insect lab, I'll get it.
Okay, great.
All right. Thank you. Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Jean in Ashland, it's your turn now. Hi, Jean.
Hi. The other day I heard this story. There's a family that had a toddler. They live in the northeast, just northeast of Ashland on the shore. And they found a tick between the child's toes, and the child's foot swelled up large, very large, and they took it to the doctor, and it was diagnosed as Rocky Mountain fever or spotted fever, and I never heard of that in this area. Where do we find the demographics of biting
You can go to the CDC and do a search on Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and you'll get a map. And as far as I'm aware, there has only been one confirmed case in the last three decades of Rocky Mountain spotted fever in Wisconsin. What's interesting is the hot spots for Rocky Mountain spotted fever include the Carolinas and Oklahoma and a lot of other places other than where you would think from the name is implied. And what's always interesting is we've got the right tick, but we don't have the disease here. I mean, just because the old-fashioned wood tick, or what we call the American dog tick, is a competent vector of that disease, but it's not a factor here. So the other thing I will tell you is, you know, the CDC cases are confirmed. There's a whole protocol they have to go through. And so sometimes what you will see is physicians, because of the symptoms, suspect it's something will treat it as such. And there's just a question, did they do the work to confirm that truly was it was or not? So it is possible, but boy, it would be an extremely rare occurrence, as I said, from what I'm aware of that disease in all parts of the upper Midwest.
Should we save our ticks that we pick off some way to have them checked out if there's something that develops unusually?
Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with saving it. The Gunderson Clinic in La Crosse will do a tick check for at least Lyme disease. I'm not sure if they do the ureculosis test, and they charge for that service. So there are places you could send the tick. You know, I guess that what I've always told people is that, you know, it's useful to have the tick, but even if the tick is carrying the disease, it does not mean it's transmitted it to you. And the other side of things, if you're going to the doctor with typical symptoms of Lyme disease or the like, whether you got the tick or not, you need to be treated. I mean, in the same with the blood work with some of this stuff, it takes a few days, if not weeks, to go positive. And so, again, if you've got the symptoms and you know you had a tick bite, most of the time the physician will treat you, even though he has not confirmed that indeed that is what the disease is.
Oh, interesting. Thanks, Gene. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And Nancy in Madison, hi to you.
Hi. I just came in from being out in the yard, and I was glad to have Phil on. We have a wood chip pile from last year. We didn't get it all spread, and so I've been out, you know, chipping away at the pile, and I've disturbed a nest of something bee-like in the wood chips. And I just got stung four times, so I'm interested in figuring out is there a way I can make them go away so I can use this? I don't really want to kill a bunch of stuff if they're pollinators and all.
Yeah, unfortunately not. I mean, bees and wasps do not translocate. They just don't want to move. And the reason they are defensive is because their nest is being threatened. So that's where you see the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in some cases, people this early are lucky enough just to seal it off. And it kind of buries them, and that would solve it. But I can't guarantee you that's the solution. So either you're going to have to let it stay until well into October, when we know that their populations will have declined, or treat it.
Okay.
All right.
And if I treated it, I would do what?
What I tend to suggest for anything that's in the ground or goes into a void, I really like the dust better than the sprays. Although if it's exposed, you know exactly where it is, then you can go just get an aerosol wasp spray at the hardware store and spray it. But typically, if I have something that goes in the ground, I know where the opening is, but I really don't know where the nest is. Then I prefer to use a dust, and probably the easiest dust to get is the 7, S-E-V-I-N, garden dust, which you can see at almost any place that sells insecticides. Usually wait till about 6 o'clock at night, just dust the entrance, and within a day or two, whether it's bumblebees or yellowjackets starting a colony, it will do them in.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Kevin in Dubuque, Iowa, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Good to hear you guys. Say, I treated a dwarf mulberry tree that's fruitless so as to keep deer away. So it was my own concoction that I got from a nursery. And you mentioned something about bringing in species of insects. I could do this mulberry tree maybe in because it draws in these insects. And I'm looking at it right now, and you may have covered it. I just tuned in. I see around this tree right now a lot of defoliage occurring with green worms inside of a, looks like a spider web nest. Wondering if I could have brought something in like that and how I might be able to treat this and save the rest of this mulberry tree before it's completely lost its leaves. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I'm a little stumped in that when I think about things that make webs, euonymus webworm, eastern tent caterpillar, and the like, They're not found on mulberry. And the timing of the year is a little bit odd because most of those things are kind of May and they're already done by now. Later in the season, we get an animal called a fall webworm, and it may be fall webworm, although I tend to see more of that on walnut and birch and a few other trees and not mulberry. How big are the worms right now?
They're about, I'm looking at them right now, there's a, and they kind of flitter in flight, too, when I come close to them right now. They kind of, like, jump around. Mm-hmm. They're about 1 inch long, maybe a couple centimeters long at the most.
Okay. Well, they may be getting closer to being done, and as I said, with a lot of these things that we only maybe have one generation, I'm not so sure it's going to get significantly worse, but these would respond to the bacterial insecticides, the BT products. They would also respond to most of the landscape sprays like Bug Be Gone and the like. You can even try just soapy water. They're starting to get big enough. Soaps tend to be compromised when the insect's skin gets too thick, and that happens when insects get bigger. So you can try the soap, but then you may have to go to a garden spray to knock them down.
And thanks for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest on the Ideas Network. Talking the world of insects now with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you listening in. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And lots of callers online here, so let's go to the phones. And Don in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi there. Phil and Larry, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The 1st of June, I had several small beetles feeding on some evening primrose. And what I did was I photographed them, I bagged them, and then I took them to Rotary Gardens for identification. And where they looked at them, and, at the photos anyway, and said, well, that's a Japanese beetle. Unlike, they said, what I had in the bag. And I told them, well, but they're all both the same creature. And so they were stumped, and I am too. They look like Japanese beetles, but they're under a quarter inch long. Can you tell me what they might be?
And when did you see these first?
This was June 2nd when
okay,
I saw those.
It's too early for a Japanese beetle. To be honest,
at that time, yeah.
We do have some things that look closely. There is a spring rose beetle, which is another scarab. It tends to be, in comparison, duller. That may be the – in fact – they used to call it the false Japanese beetle down in Illinois, where this is also found. I'd be inclined to think it was that critter, would be my first guess. But if you got pictures, email them up to me, and then I can at least give you a little bit more definitive answer. Because there are a couple other scarabs that get close to that. But Japanese beetle is just starting to come out now in numbers. My colleague Chris Williamson had kind of given me minor heart palpitations about 3 weeks ago when he did find a couple up on some roses up on Bascom Hill here on campus, which is the earliest we've ever seen them. But I'm in an area that has quite a bit of Japanese beetle, and they're just starting to show up now. And as I said, the 2nd of June, no way. It's got to be somebody different.
The Japanese beetles I have now and have had for about a week or 10 days, and they're a real problem. But this looks, in appearance, is like a Japanese beetle, color and everything.
Yeah,
but that's smaller.
That's why I think it could be the Sterigoderma arbicola is the fancy name, but it is called the spring rose beetle is one of the common names to it. Mm-hmm. And it does feed on similar things, never near as extensive as with Japanese beetle. When that gets rolling, it's everywhere. But that would be my first guess that it's Sterigoderma.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Don. Margaret in Madison, your turn now. Hi, Margaret.
Yeah, hi. This is kind of a little different call, but I want to thank you very much, Phil. A few years back, I joined the ranks of the insect paranoia, by the way. A few years back, I had something doing little worms on my clothesline, and I mailed you a sample, and you came back with the idea that it was moths that were planting. I want to tell you, you saved my sanity, okay? Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thanks for calling, Margaret.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Well, we hope that happens to a lot of people.
Yeah, well,
and I think it does.
It's nice to know, and that's one of the things. So often I hear some very interesting stories, and I give my 2 cents worth, and it's not that common for me to get feedback, and sometimes it's very important to get feedback because it kind of completes the story. Was I right? Was I wrong? Or people have perceptions or see something that adds to it. And I tell people it's nice. I thank them when they call back because it makes me that much more efficient when I'm talking to the next person, or at least able to pass on other experiences.
Thanks again. And Heath in Burlington, your turn now. Hi, Heath.
Well, hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a weird kind of story. When I was a kid, I'm 22, so this was 12 years ago-ish. I was mowing the lawn, and out of this bush shot a hornet-like thing, but it was huge. It had, to me, what it looked like, four-inch-long tentacles shooting out of its back. And I saw it for maybe a split second, and then I just ran because I was so scared.
Sure.
But I've heard they're called cadia killers or cady killers.
Well, no, the biggest wasp we have is a cicada killer, but it does not have those long filaments. What you saw is a type of ichneumonid wasp that it does not have a common name. I know it as Megarissa lunator, but they are parasites of wood-boring critters that are called horntails. And that four-inch long device is an egg-laying device that they can literally go 2 or 3 inches deep into oak, lay their eggs to go after those things. And although it looks like a stinger, it cannot sting. But, you know, when you get that whole critter and stretch it out, we're talking 6 to 7 inches now. I mean, they're very impressive, very scary looking, but interesting enough, they're harmless to people.
Okay, what was that one more time?
Megarissa lunator.
Right.
So
Megarissa lunator.
It's Megarissa, I think it is.
Hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Heath. Thank you very much for calling. And speaking of, you mentioned cicadas. We certainly had our share of cicadas.
Well, you know, it was interesting to watch. If what I told people, if you had them 17 years ago, you'll see them again. I went down to Lake Geneva, honestly, 3 times to partake and enjoy in these populations. What was quite interesting to me is the number of isolated populations we had west of Madison in Arena, Clyde, Spring Green, Muscadet. And, you know, you'd get into a woodlot and they would be everywhere and you'd go 150 yards down the road and they would not be there. And they're just starting to finish up now. And so I had gone to the Bigfoot Beach State Park in Lake Geneva. And again, you will see a lot of cast skins and still quite a few critters and lots of singing. And, you know, it's a delight because it'll be 17 years before I get a chance to experience this again.
That's a long time.
Yeah. Now, there are other broods in other parts of the U.S. if people want to travel, but this is the only one we're lucky enough to get here. There will be another population in Iowa in, I think, about 3 years, if I remember off the top of my head, but that one does not spill into any parts of Wisconsin.
And see, I had one other thing. Well, let's move on and take a call. And what I was thinking about or trying to think about will come up. Alicia in Pewaukee, it is your turn. Hi, Alicia.
Hello. I'm calling about the Red Admiral population we have this year.
Mm-hmm.
They are just absolutely phenomenal. They're everywhere. And they're landing on us. And everything. I'm an old teacher, so I pulled out my bug books and to see what they eat, and it said they like tree sap and rotten fruit, and that the caterpillars like nettle leaves, which we do have on a hillside beside us. But I have a couple oranges there for that. I have the purple finches have been eating, and I'm hoping to get the orioles, and I've only had one or two stop by. Anyway, they are loving the juice from the oranges. So then I put out some apple and some Bing cherries, and they just love that too. There'll be 2 or 3 on at one time. Could you tell me why we have the larger population this year than usual?
Well, I mean, it's a phenomena that we seem to see about every 8 to 10 years. And,
okay.
You know, what my guess is, I don't think it's a normal cycle thing that you can predict.
Yeah.
But as typical of insect populations, there are various parasites and diseases that normally keep their numbers down. And every once in a while, things get out of whack for certain things. And I'm guessing that's what's going on now, that the parasites have not killed the percentage of caterpillars that they normally do. And so then what we witness is just these tremendous populations. And I did have some early warning to this because I did have people contact me 3 or 4 weeks ago about nettles being defoliated by these little green or black spiny worms, which were the caterpillars. And so they said, I think it's something to enjoy this year. And then it's probably going to be a number of years before we see this population again. We have seen similar things historically with painted lady butterflies, which are a relative of these. They feed on thistles. So it's a related critter, but a different plant species. And both the red admirals and painted ladies migrate up here. And so we get populations coming from states south of us to start it. But I think what we're seeing now are the children of that first wave that came up here in May.
Interesting. Okay. Well, it's wonderful. Yeah, I love it.
It is a lot of fun. I was driving, my family and I were driving between Madison and Spring Green, and there were red admirals all over the place. I hated to hit them.
Well, that's it. I think a lot of people have been concerned because you look at the sides of the roads and there's just dead butterflies everywhere. And for that case, a couple people have even talked about driving slow down country roads, which is great for enjoying the butterflies, but maybe a little dangerous. So, but this will probably go on for another week to 10 days, I'm guessing. And then the question is, we will get one more generation, but it's hard to say, will it be as strong as this one or not? My gut feeling is it won't be, but we may be pleasantly surprised.
Yeah.
How long do they live?
The adults,
I think. Monarchs are about a month during, this time of year.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, are they about a similar lifespan?
Yeah, maybe a little bit shorter, but they are honestly relatively close relatives of the monarchs, so it's somewhat similar. Their migration patterns, though, are not near as definitive. It's kind of like they blow up here, but they don't necessarily migrate back down in the fall. But with the painted ladies, we know that their major population comes out of the deserts of Arizona and New Mexico. Red admirals, I think, they just kind of flush from the southern states in general.
Okay.
I've also had monarchs. When they're migrating south in the fall, I've had a roosting tree where it was just unbelievable to have that too. That was a few years ago. But anyway, thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling, and I hope you got some photos.
Yeah, that's a real special thing to see, especially in this state. I know in some states and parts of California, you can predict where they're going to show up, but where they're going to roost here is, and then again, some years we don't get the strong flights. But so that would have been pretty neat to watch.
Yeah. Thanks, Alicia, for calling. Jan in North Freedom, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hello, Phil. Well, I'm calling about a very distressing problem involving powder post beetles in the schoolhouse that I purchased north of Algoma that was built in 1886. It's brick. The whole floor is maple. We had to take out half of it because of the moisture problem that had rotted the support from below. On the part that we left, which is the front part, we did reinforce the floor from below, which has like a crawl space of like about 2 feet or so that we crawled in there. The whole center of the floor had been supported by a stone wall running from front to back. The stone wall is still there in the front half of the schoolhouse. We reinforced both sides of those with 12-foot very heavy-duty beams supported by screw jacks. So the floor is supported. However, along the outside edges, where, of course, there would be moisture having come in, powder post beetles have been invading those edges of the floor and completely decomposing it completely. You can poke all the way through them, through the floor. And so we put plastic underneath the floor too to help kind of control the moisture, and put concrete on the back half of the floor now so that we've got something there. And we haven't been unsuccessful as to find any way of dealing with these powder post beetles in our floor.
Okay, well,
do you have
two
any
things.
Ideas about that?
The moisture is what's fueling it. Powder post beetles need higher moisture contents to be
mm-hmm.
happy. So we often have trouble in older buildings that have crawl spaces and dirt floor basements and
yes.
the like. So in the long run, anything you do to dry things out will help. But in the short run, the way they are preserving wood now is with a borate treatment. Now, it's not true boric acid. It is a more water-soluble form called sodium octaborate. But the two commercial names you will see it sold under is Timbor, T-I-M-B-O-R, or another product is called Boracare. The Timbor is a powder mixed with water. The Boracare is a glycol-based liquid mixed with water, and you apply it with a paintbrush or a sprayer. But in order for this to work, the wood cannot be sealed. What it does is it soaks into the wood, and then the crystals of boric acid, basically, are there and present. And boric acid is a stomach poison. So when the powder post beetles come up to the surface to emerge, they ingest the boric acid, and that's what kills them. And the advantage is, as long as you don't have a lot of water to wash these borates out of the wood, one treatment is permanent. But the disadvantage, again, is if you've already sealed the floor, you have to sand it and open it up again so that the borates can penetrate. So is the flooring available to be able to treat, or is it sealed?
Yes, it is. It's available to be treated. It at one time had been painted, but it's worn off a lot.
Okay, well, then you're in good shape.
Yes.
Now, a little hard to chase down. If there's any Log Home Supply companies in the area, check with them.
Log Home Supply.
But the other thing is, this is another one of the things, if you do a search on Timbor on the Internet, you'll find a number of places that will UPS the stuff to you. And it's something you can easily do yourself. And because it is basically much like the boric acid that we wash our eyes with, it really does not require any kind of special techniques other than, you know, wearing gloves and just some common sense things. Once you put it in, then you can seal it, do whatever you need to do, and know that you basically insect-proof the wood that you've treated.
That would be so great. Now, Timbor was one, but then you mentioned another one.
Boracare is same active ingredient. It's just formulated different. It's B-O-R-A-C-A-R-E.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate that so much. We're going to try that.
All right. Thanks, Jan. Thanks for calling. Joan in Baraboo, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And yes, I too am enjoying the butterflies. And fear not, some of the dead ones are going to good purposes because the red-winged blackbirds. And I even noticed a gopher eating a dead butterfly.
Yeah.
Some of them are getting eaten, so I guess they're being appreciated by other things besides people. My question is, my dogs were just diagnosed with anaplasmosis. I've had Lyme disease, so I know what that's like. And I'm wondering, and I know that you had just mentioned that people can be infected with ehrlichiosis, and I'm wondering if anaplasmosis is something that can be given to people also by the darn deer ticks that we have so many of.
No, I've not heard of that association.
Oh, that's a relief, because
there is a babesiosis, which we have a handful of cases reported in the state, and it seems to be slowly getting worse. We get 8-10 cases a year, which is phenomenally high. It's also a tick-borne disease picked up from mice to people. It's a bacterial problem that is treated with antibiotics. But the anaplasmosis, I've not heard of cases, and so I don't think it can cross over.
Oh, that's good, because the vet said it's becoming a major problem with dogs, and a lot of people that don't have their dogs blood tested for Lyme disease, you know, don't even know that their animals have it. And,
mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you. You've made that a little bit easier for me.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joan. Thanks for calling. Bob in Jacksonport, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hey, good afternoon, Larry, and good afternoon, Phil.
Good afternoon.
Number one, your suggestion about emailing digital photographs to you.
Mm-hmm.
I just want all the other listeners to know that you respond so fast. It is excellent, and I thank you very much. You have identified a number of critters for me on the email.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. And my question on butterflies, I was looking out in the yard waiting for the monarchs, and I thought I saw one, and I called to my wife, and I said, the monarchs are in. We looked closer, and it was not a monarch. It had black and orange, but it had way too much black and way too little orange.
That could have been a red.
Probably a little smaller than what I would have expected for a monarch.
That, I wonder if it's this Red Admiral.
Red Admiral,
that is so
I'll
common.
Bet anything.
That description fits it quite well.
Is that the Red Admiral?
Yes. Now, yeah. I did see my first monarch in our backyard, to be honest, as early as about, I think it was about the 15th or 16th of May. So we did get an early flight, which we sometimes do not see. In fact, we've had caterpillars on our butterfly weed for the last couple weeks, and they're getting close to being done. So the monarchs, this should be a reasonable year, because we started them early, and we've seen enough milkweed out there. There should be plenty to eat.
Well, excellent. Sue has plenty of fodder for the monarchs.
Well, you described the Red Admiral to a T.
The Red Admiral.
Yeah.
Right. I'm going to Google that and take a look. I'll bet that's what it was. And thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah, sure. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And there are some. There's an orange, a kind of a reddish The Red Admiral has a kind of a reddish tinge, too, or right. can have. Yeah. So it's
See, I almost thought where he was going, we have one look-alike called the Viceroy Butterfly, which is more closely related to the Red Admiral. It is a monarch mimic, but it's somewhat smaller in size and far less frequent. It's kind of a little hard to find Viceroy Butterflies. But it's such a dead ringer for monarchs that sometimes, you know, if you're not used to looking at butterflies, you probably wouldn't be able, you would mistake it for a true monarch. Whereas the Red Admiral, as he described, much darker base wing colors, and then it just has these bands of orange, both on the hind wing and the forewing.
On to Norman Kennan.
Yeah, good afternoon. This is Norm from Kennan.
Yes, go ahead.
Say, I was going to back to the wood ticks again, or the deer ticks. Okay, when they hatch out, and they're waiting for their prey, their host. How long do they live, or what do they do if they do not find food? Do they die, or do they just go back into the ground?
Well, the whole life cycle, from egg to an adult that mates and lays eggs, typically takes 2 years. In that two-year period of time, the tick, if it's lucky and survives and is not eaten and all the other things that can happen to it, feeds only 3 times. So they spend a lot of time sitting and waiting. If they're lucky enough to find a mouse, they will feed for 2 or 3 days, fill up with blood, fall off, molt their skin, transform in the next stage, and then they got to sit and wait for the next prey to come by. And as I said, so if you look at that whole package, it is a 2-year process from the time the egg is laid until we get an adult. The females only lay eggs once, but when they lay eggs, they lay them by the thousands. And so that's how the cycle is continued.
Well, I just kind of thought they hatched out and then they were waiting, and if they didn't find anything to prey on, they would probably last, like, say, a couple of weeks or whatever and just, die or whatever.
Yeah, no, you have to admire their patience. You have to admire biologically how you can live for so long with so few meals. So they're very energy efficient, and they do go up and down if it's rainy or too windy or whatnot. To be honest, they tend to go lower and stay quiet in most of the questing. And right now, again, we had talked earlier in the show that the nymphal stage, which is a smaller stage of the deer tick, is the one that is most prevalent. And why that one is problematic is because it's small enough that it's more easily overlooked. And we do know that there are probably more cases of Lyme disease transmitted by the nymphs, even though they don't carry as much of the organism as the adults do. But because they're so small, they're overlooked. And, you know, the secret with Lyme disease is that it takes the tick at least a day, if probably not 2 days, of feeding on you to transmit the disease. So if you're removing the tick, you don't get sick if you get it on the same day. And again, because these nymphs are smaller, they're overlooked, and that's what allows them to be more successful in transmitting.
I was going to ask one more question. I heard something, too. I don't know if it was on your program once before or whatever. Is it true that they have to be, if you can get them picked off, I say if they're bit in, if you can get them picked off within, was it 2 days or whatever
yes.
it is, you will not get the Lyme disease, or is that not true?
That is true, because what the tick is doing in that first day and a half to 2 days is not even feeding. It's kind of getting its mouth part burrowed in. In the case of deer ticks, literally cemented in. I mean, that's why, if you ever wonder why it's so hard to get them out, these things are barbed like a fish hook with multiple little back teeth, and it cuts that in, and then it cements it in. And so it cannot very easily be removed, whereas the wood tick has a much shorter mouth part, and it does not cement it in, so people have far better success in removing wood ticks because they don't go as deep, and again, they're not glued in.
And thanks a lot for calling, Norman. Phil, thank you.
And nice to be here, Larry.
Yeah, it's great. We had lots of good questions and appreciate it. We'll look forward to your next visit. And by the way, you're going to be at the Berner Botanical Garden on Saturday?
Yeah, we're having a kickoff. We're having the opening of really the diagnostic center there between, it's a kind of a joint thing between the county and the extension and whatnot. And myself and colleagues will be there between 11 and 1 doing an Ask the Expert. So people in the Milwaukee area, you got strange bugs crawling around, bring them on over and we'll tell you what you got.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest. Thanks a lot, Phil, and we'll look forward to another visit from you. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.